Call them change makers.
Call them rule breakers.
We call them redefiners.
Join us in conversation with daring leaders who are creating extraordinary impact and driving change from around the globe.
Each episode gives you a fresh perspective on your leadership and career journey. I'm Hoda Tahoon, a leadership advisor at Russell Reynolds.
I'm Clark Murphy, the former chief executive officer and a leadership advisor. And this is Redefiners. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Redefiners. Today, we're going to accelerate a bit and talk to a leader who is literally in the fast lane of global business and innovation. She's a well-known and visible leader in the auto industry and now motorsports, leading a team behind some of the world's most exciting races, both on and off the track. But before we introduce our guest, I wanted to introduce our listeners to our newest Redefiners co-host, Simon Kingston, who is my friend and partner based in London, also a founder and host of a history festival in Cork, Ireland. So this will be really fun and very interesting. Simon, welcome to Redefiners.
Hello, Clark. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, Simon, we're excited that you're joining us for several episodes this year. If you give us a little bit of your background, putting you on the talking part here before we go to our guest.
Well, thank you. I'm based in London office, as you mentioned, but I am Irish. I grew up on both sides of the Irish border and for some periods almost directly on it. And I'm a spoiled historian. I was a baby academic before becoming a leadership advisor. I now co-lead our social impact and education sector for the firm, working with a host of organizations. And when I'm not doing that, I am either in London or in West Cork with my wife, with two children, and at the moment with two misbehaved dogs.
We are so excited you're here, Simon. Nothing more fun than being on a panel with you. And the fact that we have two Irishmen here, it probably makes people nervous. So let's not take any more pit stops, pun intended. We are excited to hear about our guest. Simon, tell us who we're hosting today.
Delighted to. And our guest today, and she's very welcome, is Natalie Robin. Natalie is the chief executive of the FIA, the International Automobile Federation. For our French-speaking listeners, that's the Fédération Internationale de l'Automobile. I fear, given my pronunciation, our French listeners are none the wiser. So, la francophonie, je suis désolé. But the FIA, importantly, is the governing body for world motorsport. People will be very familiar, I suspect, with Formula One, but as we'll discover, there are a host of other races that the FIA oversees. And it's also the federation for a very wide range of other motoring organizations. It's got 242 members in 147 countries. And Natalie is its first chief executive. So it's going to be really interesting to hear her talk a bit about the mandate she was given, the growth and diversification work that she's doing, and where she sees the FIA going over the next few years. She's, of course, brilliantly equipped to undertake that task, having had a glittering career in the automotive sector prior to joining FIA. And she worked with Volvo, with Nissan, and with Daimler Chrysler before taking the task on.
Natalie, welcome to Redefiners.
Thank you, Simon, for that lovely introduction. Thank you, Clark. It's lovely to see both of you, and it's an honor and a pleasure to be here with you.
Natalie, we hear about car guys and car girls. How did you get in the auto business? You've been in it a long time. What got you interested, and how did you pursue it?
I wanted to go to Paris, but actually, if I rephrase it a little bit, I did start my career in investment banking. Back in the day was a Cisco network appliance, a storage infrastructure, data networking. And as a follow-up to being kind of on the equity research side and listening to a lot of the CEOs and the CFOs give their quarterly updates, I thought I wanted to go and pursue my MBA and be on the other side of the table at one point. And in this process, it just so happened that there was a really interesting management project available at Delphi in Paris, or on the outskirts of Paris. Delphi is an automotive supplier. And so I took that assignment for, I think it was 8 months. It was back in the days of Six Sigma, looking at how they were procuring supplies across Europe and seeing if it could be done in a more consolidated way. And that was really my first step into automotive. It started on the supplier side. And whilst I was finishing my MBA, I just happened to have a discussion with some of the folks at Daimler Chrysler from the finance side, from financial services, when they were visiting our campus. And it turned into me saying, well, you know, I'd really like to be more on the operational, on the commercial side. And lo and behold, I started in this program at Daimler, which was called a management training program, the Internationale Nachwuchsgruppe, based out of Stuttgart and Detroit at the time, right? Because Daimler and Chrysler were together back in those days. And that was my first step into this beautiful world of automotive, which many people said, what are you going into automotive and why are you going to Detroit? How unsexy and unexciting. But it's actually quite the opposite, I found. There was the luster and the star power of Mercedes, but Chrysler was really, for me, one of the most wonderful experiences of my career, just because it's one of the big three, the smallest of the big three from the Detroit automakers. Lots of up and downs, lots of turbulence, and everyone around in Detroit at the Chrysler Technical Center when I was there was saying, well, you know, we got a problem. Everybody just let's huddle in the room, roll up your sleeves, you, pointing across the room, and we'd all get in there. So it was a great chance for me to learn a lot in an industry which actually is so interesting because it's so vertically integrated, right? From the procurement of the raw materials up into the services that we provide to the customers or the second and third and fourth lives for vehicles.
Are you a problem solver by nature, or did you have to develop that by going to Chrysler and being picked as one of those people in the room?
No, I think I'm a bit of a problem solver by nature. And there was a big difference between Daimler and Chrysler because I spent equal times in both the Stuttgart offices in Germany and the Detroit offices. And in Stuttgart, it was much more formalized. And you had a role, you would stay within the box of your role. Very efficient way of working as well. But when you would get called on is when you would speak. Chrysler was quite different. I'd say it's maybe a bit more American style, which was, well, let's see who's around and who can help support. And from that perspective, for me, it was great because I like to sit around. I like to work on problems with people from different areas, from different departments, from different backgrounds. So it fit really well. And I did enjoy my time immensely in Detroit and at Chrysler while I was there.
Is it hard to toggle between the two? I think a lot of people, if one is more formal or more informal, they find differently, particularly culture. I worked actually in Frankfurt for a number of years in our firm and certainly had to adjust, though being an English speaker helped a lot versus the formal high German. How did you find it to toggle back and forth?
Well, I found it okay. At that point, I was just starting off my career. I found it pretty exciting to have the international aspect of it with a lot of the Germans that we had. And I was working in Chrysler International at the moment, which touched, of course, all of our operations globally. Yeah, it's very, very different ways of working. But I would say what I saw afterwards when there was a separation of Chrysler and Daimler and the unification into the Fiat group of Chrysler, I think that was a little more challenging. There's a bit more cultural differences there, if we want to really dig into it, than there was from what I experienced between the Germans and the Americans. And there was the CEO also of Daimler and Chrysler at the time, Dieter Zetsche, who was a star and really fun to have around in the technical center. And he adapted quite a bit to the U.S. He made a concerted effort to try and deformalize a little bit, particularly when he was in Detroit. So from my perspective, it was exciting. It was fun. And it was all part of when you're just starting off, everything's a learning process. So you're just soaking it all up like a sponge.
On this podcast, we like to talk about redefiner moments. Through that, and indeed, as you look back on your career as a whole, was there a redefining moment for you that sort of shaped how you lead, given that diversity of early experience?
I think there was probably several redefining moments. I can't think of one pivotal moment that changed entirely the way that I've developed or I've led, but there was several moments. Your upbringing, your surroundings, all of them help to shape you. Leaders that you work with or colleagues that you have. In my case, I think it was in another company when I was working, recognizing that my career was being maybe decided for me by the powers that be or by a supervisor or a boss, and starting to say, well, I'm not sure if that's the path that I want to take. And taking that step to really choose for myself what I wanted was pivotal for me to start my real journey. In my case, it was, well, working in automotive and getting a lot of soft pressure to maybe move into the marketing area. Maybe that's also more female-centric. I remember when I was looking at one point to say, well, you know, I think I'm ready. I've been working on the commercial side, on the sales side. I'd like to go into a market as a managing director, run the P&L, be responsible for the operations there, and getting a lot of, well, you know, we got some, the marketing division that's looking for additional people and maybe in communications. And I was saying, well, I don't really have that background at all. I know, but it fits perfect. And at one point, you know, it would have been pretty easy to just say, well, okay, yeah, I guess that's probably where I should go. And I just remember reflecting over it and saying, well, no, actually, that's not what I want to do. And if that's not available here, then I'll go somewhere else. And I did. And I went somewhere else and found my path. So I think that's something that was pretty pivotal, is that I had the courage to just kind of push back for what I wanted.
My guess is there were not many female role models doing that. And you've kind of already said it. So what do you think was it that gave you the sense of purpose, the sense of courage, as you said, to say, no, I'm going to do this?
Fortunately, I have a lot of self-confidence that I got from it. Maybe it was from my family, from my dad, who was wonderful in bringing me up and always including me in the sporting activities with my brother and making sure that I was always part of the crowd, never making it feel like there was anything different. Well, we're going to go toss the ball around outside. Come on, let's go. We're going to go, you know, play football over here. We're going to skiing. We're going to, let's go. So that was always really helpful to have a really strong male mentor growing up. Mm-hmm. Next to that, I had great colleagues and I had a lot of great mentors that were also male when I was starting in automotive industry, who really pushed me to move forward and to speak up. So that was really helpful. And I think in this case, just being able to sit back and reflect and say, well, I need to decide what I want to do next. And just taking that step. And maybe when I went back to the office the next day and said, no, I don't want to do a marketing role. And for me, that was probably the quick moment, because that's when I decided to join Volvo. And in Volvo, everything changed.
We're going to come on to it and the way you lead now, but what changed?
Well, I was working in commercial and in sales and automotive. I was one of the very few females in the room. And I go back 20 years ago when I started in automotive, things have changed really quite a bit in terms of diversity that we start to see, because organizations have recognized that diversity is really important as well, you know, across the board, whether it be gender diversity, cultural diversity, et cetera. We've changed a bit. But when I moved to Volvo, I got this opportunity to move up to this place that I had never even heard of, you know, Gothenburg in Sweden. I didn't even know where this place was. And I remember talking to some of my colleagues from the automotive world, and they were saying, Volvo, gosh, yeah, fairly, but this, you know, this was maybe almost 15 years ago. They say, you don't really see those. It looks like a real cool company, but you don't really see many of those cars around. It's so obscure. Where on earth are they? Right. And I just took, I started talking to some of the management team. I really, really liked the vision. I really liked the culture. I liked the people that I would potentially be working with. The interview process was wonderful. I got to speak to many, many different people within the company. And as soon as I got there, I went from being the only female in the boardroom with all the management team to being probably one of almost 40%. So everything changed. And it also changed the way that I worked. Volvo and the Swedes are pretty progressive when you think about it. And when it comes to gender balance, I think they're quite advanced compared to a lot of the Scandinavian countries, compared to the rest of the world, I would say. For me, it was a different sensation. And I never recognized it, right? Because I had been working in this environment for my entire career up until my late 30s. So I never recognized how at ease I suddenly felt when I showed up in this new country, in this new organization, and in this new meeting room surrounded by all these different people, in a relaxed environment where I looked around and I said, well, she looks like me and so does she. And we're kind of speaking the same. It was a real change for me, and also the flatter hierarchy I felt very comfortable with and the way of working there. So that was a pretty wonderful change for me.
That would be a redefining moment, it sounds like.
Yeah.
How did we get to motorsports from, I haven't seen the Volvo racing team, but how did you get from Volvo to motorsports? And also, you're the first chief executive. Since the founding in 1904, it's always been a president, and now they have a structure of a chief executive. So tell us about the journey and the arrival, if you will, as the CEO.
Well, I was contacted and said, well, they're looking for a CEO at the FIA. Would you be interested? And I said, what's the FIA? And they said, that's the International Automobile Federation, or as Simon so beautifully put it before, the Federación Internacional del Automóvil. And I said, gosh, never heard of that. Let me take a look. As you correctly mentioned, Clark, I was working at Volvo. We had no motorsport activity. It was not something that was really on the radar at the moment. And I started to look online and understand, and I thought, my goodness, so this is a real enormous entity that you summarized earlier that has 242 clubs across roughly 150 countries. It has 80 million plus members because it has two branches. It has the motorsport, which it's the governing and regulatory body, but it also has mobility. So it combines almost all of the mobility clubs in the world. It's one of the world's largest nonprofit consumer organizations. So it's a really, really large scope that exists here. And they were looking to transform and to change the structure of the federation. So a new presidential team came in. It is an institution that is run by elected officials. And then you have the administrative part or the staff, which includes myself and all the team here. And a new presidential team came in, taking over for the previous president who had had a three-term tenure, which was Yan Tot. And in comes Mohammed bin Sulayem with his team. And they say, you know, we really need to relook at this. This is an entity that's set up, it looks like, in really three very unique pillars, creating three big silos: mobility, motorsport, and then there's the administrative part in the middle that's really run by an accountant, a chief accounting officer. We want to bring in more transparency. We are a nonprofit organization, not like a commercial entity, but mirroring a commercial entity so we can have stronger processes, determine our activities based on better KPIs, better structure, and overall be able to generate additional revenue to reinvest into these activities. So that's what they were looking for in a CEO, to kind of lead and spearhead this consolidation. And I came with this philosophy that I'm coming from, of the way I work, of the way I like to organize myself in the workplace, how I build teams and the structure and kind of my philosophies behind leadership. And at some point they said, well, come on over if you dare, join us and let's start this this project together.
Wow. You mentioned your philosophy on leadership. What is that philosophy, particularly as it relates to something this spread out globally? And it's a nonprofit, having worked for profits, but yet you're reinvesting all the time. Tell us about how do you look at being a CEO in leadership?
For me, it's really important to build a very strong, capable team. So this is the first thing that I always go into in every organization or in every entity. It's try and put the best possible people around me that are the experts in their disciplines and in their domains and let them work. Give them the autonomy, give them the trust to work and create a safe environment and a safe space where we can all collaborate together, have fun. This is super important for me at the same time. Enjoy our days and really put tasks that are meaningful on the table and have the right purpose. There's clearly a huge purpose here at the FIA. So some of that part is easy. Coming into a nonprofit and to a political organization is completely different than working in a commercial organization. It's very different. I couldn't have ever anticipated how stark the changes would be coming from where we all essentially in automotive or so when you're working in a commercial entity, we all essentially have the same objectives, which is sell as many cars as possible or services, et cetera, mobility solutions at the highest revenue possible. So maximize money, maximize sales, right? Here, it's completely different. Maybe Motorsport UK has completely different objectives than Motorsport Mozambique. So all that has to be balanced in a very different way. And I've learned a lot about how you have to just also let some things go, focus on the big things, focus on some of the most important tasks that you know are going to be the big wins. And also, I came in here assuming that I could do some of the same things that I've always done in the past in my career, which is really structure control and have extremely clear processes, everything very meticulously organized. That's impossible in a place like this. Impossible. So you got to let some of those things slide off your back. And you also have to come in with a very flexible mindset. I came in also and there had been some ongoing projects at looking about how we could make this organization and this entity more efficient. Well, obviously, that was maybe somewhat naive and not the way that you do that in an entity that is international covering so many countries, because every little thing you want to touch and eliminate will absolutely be a huge thing to one specific country or to one member, and they will not stand for that. So we have to find the right balance, or we have to find the right equation so we can support all these activities in a way that makes sense.
Natalie, I am forever telling Clark that the nonprofit leaders that we help advise have the toughest jobs in the world. Finally, he may now believe me, having heard it from you, because that complexity really strikes an echo with what we hear other leaders in multi-country or multi-stakeholder partnerships describe. But can we zoom in on one bit of the complexity? Because you've described this extraordinary three-part organization. But on the motorsports bit of it. Even within that, as we've been reading about this, the variety of activity comes through. People will have heard of Formula One, people will have heard of Le Mans, but you also lead all of these World Rally Championships. You've got the baby sister or brother of Formula One and Formula E. It's an extraordinary panoply of competitions that you help oversee and govern. I'm kind of intrigued. How do they interrelate when it comes to learning both about innovations in competition rules and in the debt? How do you have one inform the other?
Well, let me start by inviting Clark to come and spend a couple of days or a week here so you can see what it is like to be in a nonprofit organization like this. I don't think I could have ever in a million years imagined it until I joined here.
I'm in.
And I did some research. But to your question, Simon, there is a lot of still individual needs and there's a lot of individual support and balance behind all of these specific activities or our 7FIA World Championships or all our events in our international calendar. But when you start to look at what we're doing here more and more, there is sharing of information and there is sharing of data. I mean, the first and foremost one and the most specific is safety. So this is a clear example of where learning from one category helps feed all others. When we make safe improvements on top categories, then we kind of define it a roadmap to cascade them into other categories or other championships. One example would be the halo. It's like a T-bar over the cockpit that you see. Mm-hmm. I was looking back over the last, I would say 10, 15 years. And when you look at the safety standards that have been taken into place since then, I mean, it's really remarkable. Electrification, that's one example. So Formula E, you mentioned before, this is probably the innovator behind a full electric championship. But some of the learnings that have come from the Formula E championship, these technologies are now being applied into other categories or other races.
Some of these innovations, both in safety and in technology, must ultimately feed into the domestic automotive world, into the world beyond FIA. Does that happen accidentally? Do you think about encouraging that deliberately? How do you see that unfold?
I mean, coming from a commercial car company that's going 100% electric, one of the beauties of motorsport here is that you see that there's research into alternative combustion. So it's electrification, of course, and it's next gen electrification. I mean, what we're talking about when you see Formula E and the next generation is really, really high tech. But there's alternative sustainable fuels. There's also hydrogen that there's quite a bit of research on. All of this and overall, even on the sustainability side, which I suppose we'll talk about, you'll start to see some of the developments and some of the innovation that goes into motorsport. It's like a little laboratory, right? Where you can put in resources and some of the companies they put in the funds, and then this starts to be visible or new technology that can be taken into the commercial entity. Now we start to hear about car connectivity or artificial intelligence. Right when I was leaving Volvo, we were talking about now driver monitoring. Will they start to commercialize driver monitoring in the future? Well, potentially, that's something that would normally start first, maybe in motorsport. You would start to see that first in this higher technology where we act as kind of a little laboratory for innovation and new technology. So 100% things like that can then trickle into the commercial world.
We'll be right back with Natalie Robin, but first we'll hear from Dee Fitzgerald, a managing director in our Sydney office, who will highlight how important it is for CEOs to have the right top team around them and the five actions CEOs can take to maximize C-suite performance.
As a CEO, surrounding yourself with the right executive team is one of the most important levers you have for navigating an increasingly complex business environment. But in our recent research, we identify that only 2 in 5 leaders feel confident about their C-suite's ability to drive performance. So what's holding C-suite teams back? How do you build and develop a successful top team? We've identified 5 key actions that CEOs can take to supercharge C-suite performance. Number 1. Prioritize CXOs who are committed to achieving shared goals and are aligned on their purpose. Number 2, proactively build a top team with a diversity of skills, experiences, and backgrounds. Number 3, find leaders who are confident in making decisions and navigating uncertainty. Number 4, enable a culture of collaboration, trust, and psychological safety. Number 5, continually assess and engage next generation leaders to develop robust succession plans. To learn more about the 5 elements of C-suite success and the steps you can take to supercharge C-suite performance at your organization, click the link to the article in the show notes or visit russellreynolds.com.
And now, back to our conversation with Natalie.
So if we just follow up on the data analytics bit, you have, as I understand it, producing about 300 sensors aboard the Formula One. And I spend a lot of time racing sailboats. And so the sailboat, the America's Cup helps inform cruising boats show up 5 years later. We all thought of, you know, Ferrari and Ford and all of those changing how cars were developed and operated later. So you have something like 1.5 terabytes of data across these races. How does data analytics flow through, as you were just describing, from there?
Mm-hmm.
The little laboratory. We love the laboratory concept.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, it depends on how you count it, but we actually probably have way more than 300 sensors. I mean, each ERS battery, energy recovery system battery pack, has about 2 sensors on each of the 200 cells. So there you go, you have 400 sensors. We typically look at it as having about 30,000 plus signals per car available in real time and 3+ terabytes of data per race weekend. Once you start to include peripheral data, such as videos, radio, as well as various sensors on the track, many are used also in our remote race operations control center here. Also worth to mention that by definition that we bring in about 10 times more data than each team since we have 10 teams.
And sustainability, we think about the fuel of, again, we want to get out of Formula One to some of the other mobility examples. But talk about sustainability, which wouldn't occur to a listener first when you think about racing cars.
One of the things that a lot of people think when you talk about motorsport from a sustainability perspective, this is just terrible. So we look at ourselves as the FIA, the organization, right, and the employees that we have here. And we also look at the motorsport world and the competitions. When you look at the competitions, the biggest impact on CO2 is the logistics. And I hate to tell you, Clark, that's probably the same for sailing competitions when they're moving all that equipment from one location to another and back and forth. This is really where the biggest CO2 impact happens. So for us, these are the parts that we're looking at seeing, okay, how can we do more remote operations? How can we have less travel? How can we keep events potentially regionalized as opposed to having what it could be one race at some in the US, another race in Japan, then back to a race in South America, et cetera. So we're looking at trying to regionalize and making those trajectories a little bit smaller. We're also looking at the championships themselves, targeting carbon neutrality. It's all of this that you're looking at, which is introducing sustainable fuels, pushing also across all of the FIA championships with regulations, additional. You're seeing even the championships come in individually and say, well, now we're looking at increasing our electrification, or we're looking at introducing sustainable fuels that come from like biomatter. Another part that's really interesting is tire and brake particles. So in Europe, we know that about 50% of particle matters generated by road traffic comes from tires and brakes. So here we're doing a lot of research in terms of what measures can we take to minimize that particle deployment? What other regulations can we do? There's a lot of special implementations that we start to say, okay, can we take this into the championship level? And then we ourselves at the FIA, right, we're doing the same. We're trying to reduce our amount of travel. For instance, we have another office in Paris. I'm in the Geneva. We only travel via train. So no air travel permitted to those between these two locations. Lots and lots of measures that are being taken place. And again, the important thing is to have the discussion about this and to recognize, okay, let's just speak openly and say, where is the majority of the CO2 impact coming from? Can we change? What is it? Can we adjust? And I think those are the conversations that need to be happening and are happening more and more now.
It's really interesting. I don't think anyone would have guessed that FIA executives travel between offices by train. That's a fact for this podcast. And more widely amongst the members, how is that conversation received when you're using your influence in that way? When we talked about the trickle-down of technology from the races into the cars that most people drive every day, is there an equivalent sort of trickle-down of that thinking about sustainability, carbon neutrality from the racing part into the mobility part of the membership?
Yeah, absolutely. There's countries or there's regions that are more aggressively focused on carbon neutrality and maybe on electrification, like we see here in Europe, versus other areas. But it is a topic of conversation today globally. It's something that you're seeing more and more. Here we have TCS. It's all the roadside assistance and support for all of the customers of vehicles in this country. So here in Switzerland is a small example, and every country has the same. This is on the agenda of consumers, right? They're all trying to decide, well, should I get a high electric car, or will there be enough charging, or do I want a hybrid, or do I want to look at something else, or should I continue on internal combustion engine? So these are all questions. So we conduct a lot of research. We have a lot of information. We disseminate that also to our clubs that they can provide also to their consumers to help make educated decisions. And this is a topic that they have also on their table. Sustainability, usually when we get together for general assemblies, we might have a topic like that. You start to see more and more people showing up in the room. I think it's a relevant topic today. So it's visible both on the mobility side and on the motorsport side.
And you talk about the difference in attitudes to that in different parts of the world, the different speeds, as it were, at which the world is moving on sustainability. But that's not the only thing that's multi-regional about what FIA does. This year, there'll be three more races in the US on the calendar. We understand the first race in Shanghai is coming up this year, and you're looking at other venues, east and south, in the world, as it were. How do you, in the face of that kind of growth opportunity, balance the risk and reward ratio when you're thinking about new venues? Obviously, safety is one part of that, as well as the audience. How do you think about expansion in geographical terms?
We want accessible motorsport for all, right? That means that the more activity we have, the more relevant that motorsport is, and that the more people can participate. Now, that does become tricky, right? 24 races means more regulation, more standards, more complexity. When we go to an event, there's several main stakeholders. There's the FIA. We license, we sanction the championships. We ensure that fair and safe standards are delivered throughout the whole competition. Then you have FOM, which is Formula One Management. So this is the commercial rights holder of Formula One. They manage all the commercial aspects of the championships globally. And then you have the local motorsport federation. So this is the entity that delivers the authorization to run the motorsport races in the territories. And there's only one per country. So it's the key stakeholder to deal with the local politics. They have a strong relationship with their local government. They're in charge of the administration. They gather the volunteers and officials that help us manage the race. That is usually on average about 1,000 volunteers per race. Without these guys, we could not do anything. And then we also have a local promoter who could also potentially be the National Sporting Federation or another organization that kind of promotes the event locally, sells the tickets, and the circuit. This is one of the main parts, right? This is the infrastructure. We also ensure that that circuit is fit and is enabled and run a race. And this is what we do regularly. So every single circuit has to have a FIA circuit license. All of these aspects are what we do for every single race and every single event.
So one of the things when we are helping our clients, boards of directors, choose their next chief executive, increasingly in the last four or five years, we focused on complexity and the ability to prioritize. Talk to us as a leader about how you have learned to handle more complexity and the surprise, it sounds like, of complexity in this role.
It all goes back to at the very beginning when I said you try and find the best people and those who know how to work and drive their domains and let them do their job and try and create the space for them to do their job. I've spent the last year here pretty much holed up in this office trying to restructure and set up the right management team that helps to support all of the activity that we do and let those experts that come in, whether it be the head of single seater, whether it be the head of road sport, whether it be the head of circuit sport, whether it be the head of commercial operations, all of these are new members to this organization. Some came from within and were brought up. Some came externally. Those individuals put their own teams together, put their own structures together. And my job is to help permeate the important things into them. And then again, it's back to prioritize.
Yes.
An important strategy for me is deciding what not to do every day. So I come in and I think, my goodness, okay, well, today I'll do this, that, and the other. Sometimes I get a little overwhelmed and then I have to reflect and say, well, you know what? That'll be tomorrow or that'll be the day after.
And we believe that excellent leaders, certainly chief executives, have the capability, which not everyone has, to decide what not to do as opposed to I'll do more. And that can define great leaders right there, amongst many other things.
Yes, so these are the recommendations that I usually give And then it's up to them to ultimately decide if that's the case or not. If they decide, well, we want to continue this, or then I might need to go out and say, well, we'll need additional resources to get this done. So we'll start looking at it in different ways. But it's also raising your hand when you need help. And for me, but this has never been a big issue, is when I don't know something, I just say, I don't know. I need people to help me do this because I really don't know. And that's part of also making a really good team. And here, there's a lot I don't know. I didn't know anything about motorsport before I came here. I know about building teams and organizational structures and frameworks and putting processes in place. I'm starting to learn a little bit about motorsport. But as some of my motorsport colleagues say, you knew nothing and now you know this teeny tiny bit, and we're going to work on getting you more up to speed. But they're the ones, they're the experts, and I got to let them do their jobs too.
Well, thank you for sharing so much of it with us, Natalie, along with the fact that Detroit is sexy and Gothenburg is okay too, which is these two additional gems of information. As regular listeners will know, we like to end each podcast with some rapid fire questions. And so this is where we ask you a set of poses and ask you to respond as quickly as possible. So are you ready for that?
I am ready.
You speak four languages, English, Spanish, French, and German. Is there another language you want to learn?
I would love to learn Mandarin. I would like to learn those four that you mentioned first properly, though, because I really do not speak any of them the way I should.
Well, don't worry. Simon doesn't speak English either, so you're in good company. What was your first car?
Jeep Sahara, 1993.
What was the fastest you've ever driven in a car?
Poof. I'm not sure if I can say that.
Sure you can. Come on. You're in Switzerland. It's okay.
Let's see. 263.
Whoa. Okay. That's called fast.
Kilometers, Clark, not miles per hour.
No, I wanted to go with the MPH. It's more fun. When do you do your best thinking? Morning, afternoon, or evening?
No question, morning.
What's the best leadership advice you've ever received?
If you fall down, get back up, put your boots on, and keep marching.
There you go. And do you learn best by watching, or do you learn by doing?
Both.
Finally, after a long day at work, and we've heard about some of those, what's your favorite way to decompress?
My favorite way to decompress is driving home, cuddling with my 5-year-old daughter and my husband, and just sitting together and chatting and laughing and forgetting all about my day and just listening to this hilarious little dumpling that makes my evening. Family always has, always will.
Well, Natalie, we can't thank you enough for being here in an incredibly wide-ranging discussion. And there are some themes, if we think about it in summary, that part of it is about culture and adapting. If you think about your formative years with American, German, Italian, and Swedish companies, there's probably no better training for the world you live in today and this job you're in, this adaptability. And you talked about, I think, a defining moment was in your family and your father giving you the self-confidence of being who you could be. It didn't matter if you were a man or a woman, but that defined you to help choose the path. When someone said, why don't you do this, which fits into the role model of perhaps women's careers, you said, I don't really want to do that. I want to do what I want to do. So the self-confidence defined by your family helped you choose the path that you did. But the redefining moment, I think, was showing up in Gothenburg, Sweden, and saying, wow, I fit here. I recognize these people. I'm at home. I can be who I want to be in a culture that says, who are we going to be? But then this next moment of going to a large nonprofit, it's really quite amazing. 250 clubs, 230 events, 80 million members. And so it's not German, Italian, or Swedish. It's all of it, having to answer to that. And so you develop your philosophy on leadership because of this multicultural. It wasn't hierarchical. It wasn't structural. It wasn't kind of call on who wants to help solve the problem. You had all of that, which is something we should think about for our listeners in terms of a global culture. To you, it's building the team first. It's making sure you and the team enjoy the day, live the purpose, and understanding that the nonprofit is very different. That's not about selling as many cars as possible. It's sharing the data and learning from the data that gets spread across a massive organization. But the last philosophy of business is learning what to let go. As we talked about, that the great leaders can prioritize and then be a better leader by letting the teams do what they want to do. from a sustainability standpoint, this concept of learning and sharing the data, then we look at just in Europe, the tires and brakes. How do we change from the racing world to the street world, reducing particulate or any other aspect of fuels, hydrogen? So taking these learnings from the mobility and sports clubs into what we do on the road every single day. And finally, complexity. Back to complexity. You have multiple countries to work through, and you've decided, I'm not going to be Superwoman. I'm going to say, I don't know what the answer is. I've built teams of experts and let the teams figure out what I don't and can't figure out. So this sense of what you've come through to building great teams, to letting them make decisions as well as you, is a lot to learn from here. We are really, really appreciative. I am going to come visit you because I want to go 260 kilometers per hour. So if you'll let us come, we're heading your way. Thank you for coming our way today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. And please visit me one day. It'd be a pleasure to have either of you. Our doors are open in Geneva and in Paris at the FIA for all of you.
Thank you, Natalie.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Redefiners. For more compelling insights from leaders across industries and around the world, listen to Redefiners wherever you get your podcasts.
To learn more or get in contact with us, follow Redefiners Podcast on Instagram, find Russell Reynolds Associates on LinkedIn, X, and YouTube, and visit our website at russellreynolds.com.